is nice. The court always likes to have people come to oral argument, and my notes tell me we have a high school class here today from Loyal High School. If that's the case, would you all please stand? Oh, wow, wonderful.
This is really court with class. Do you notice the gentlemen are wearing ties?
Thank you. You may be seated. Yes, so the students are here on a program that we operate in coordination with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they know a little bit about the case that you're going to be arguing to us today. Now, if you students can remain after the second argument, we have another one that starts at 10:45, so about 12 o'clock or 10 after 12, Justice Annette Ziegler will come down and chat with you a little bit about not the merits of the case, but about how cases get to the Supreme Court and answer some questions that you may have concerning the court. So if you can stay, please do. And anybody else who would like to attend certainly is welcome, in addition to the students and their advisors. Before I call the first case, I will announce, as I will for every case today, that Shirley Abramson, who usually sits to the right of me, is not participating. So she has withdrawn from participation for all the cases that we will be hearing today. So we shall now begin State versus Fitzgerald. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. Assistant State Public Defender Colleen Ball appearing on behalf of the petitioner Raytrell Fitzgerald. It's black letter law that a defendant has a significant constitutional liberty interest in unwanted antipsychotic medication, and this appeal concerns the state's ability to overcome that liberty interest in a particular setting, and that's the setting where the state wants to render the defendant competent to stand trial. It's undisputed that antipsychotic medications can have very dangerous side effects, including death. It's undisputed that they affect a defendant's thoughts and his ability to perceive the world. It's undisputed, and this is most important for today, that they can affect the defendant's fair trial rights. They can make him jittery. They can make him sedated so that it's hard to make the decision to consult counsel during the trial or to track what's going on in trial or to even show emotion before the jury that's going to decide his fate. And for that reason, the United States Supreme Court in Sell versus United States imposed a very stringent four-part test that the state has to satisfy in order to administer involuntary medication in order to render the defendant competent for trial. So the questions for today are, did Sell versus United States render 971.14 unconstitutional? And secondly, is the involuntary medication order at issue here, does it violate Sell and therefore substantive due process?
Counsel, was the form 206 that is generally filled out when a medication order is issued, was it prepared in this case? I didn't see it in the record.
The court did not ultimately, you know what, I need to go back and double check that. I believe the court orally, it was, okay.
The court
signed.
Ordered it and then stayed it. And
right.
Then said
the
it
court
was
signed
put
it
back
and then,
in place
that's right.
And then
that's
didn't
right.
put it back in place. So I wasn't sure where we were.
Have an involuntary medication order. It was then orally stayed.
Right.
Orally, it wasn't stayed. orally, the judge said, prepare an order lifting the stay. Yeah. But that's the next case. So today at this first case, all we're going to focus on is, was the order that they did sign, did that comply with Sell?
Okay, in the status of that order is that it is currently stayed. Is that correct?
Well, the case, yes, it's currently stayed, so to speak, but the case has resolved. Right.
Okay, so I'm clear on the facts, because each of these cases seem to have a little wrinkle, and you have two for this particular defendant before us today. So the court issued the order for medication. then orally stated, then said it was not going to stay it, but in fact the stay remained, correct?
He issued the order for involuntary medication, and that is the subject of this appeal.
Okay, but
next, he orally says, I am lifting the order for, I'm lifting the stay so that medication may proceed. And then he says to the state, you prepare a written order lifting the stay, and he never actually signs that order.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get to is the order was stayed. He wasn't medicated under a court order.
That is correct.
Okay, that's all I was
trying to get orally,
to.
Yes.
Well,
in effect. And then the case results.
Factually, your client was never medicated under a court order.
Actually, my client insisted on his right to refuse medication. That's right.
I know, but you're not trying not to answer my question.
No, I'm exactly answering your question,
well,
Your Honor.
My question
he was ordered.
Was he medicated under a court order?
No.
Okay. That's all I
okay.
needed to clarify.
All right. So the first
counsel, with regard to the order, then, just for my clarification, the order that we're referring to is the order that's on pages 102 and 103 of the appendix part of your brief, which is filed June 18th, 2018. Isn't that what we're looking at?
That is correct. And it's important to understand these really are two different proceedings. Right now, we have an appeal from this order that you just highlighted, Justice Bradley, the one that was entered on June 18th. Events proceeded afterwards, and that resulted in a petition for supervisory writ. And that's what we're going to talk about in the next proceeding. Okay?
So let's talk about the constitutionality of 971.14.
Okay. Sorry.
So does that statute prevent courts from considering the cell factors?
I think it does, Your Honor.
Why, how does it do that?
Okay. If I could have just like a minute, I'd love to walk the court through that statute. The first problem that we have with that statute is that it, in 1989, the Wisconsin legislature...
Well, before you do that, I just want to know, how does the statute prohibit the court from considering the cell factors?
Well, why don't we go through it section by section. Under the statute, subsection DM would be the first place where a court could potentially apply cell factors, okay? And at that stage, the statute says that an examiner is supposed to examine the condition of a defendant, and it's supposed to report on whether or not he's competent for trial and whether or not he's competent to refuse medication, okay? Now, there's a couple problems there. One is, at this point, it's just an examiner. This isn't a treating physician. An examiner could be a psychologist. An examiner could be a psychiatrist. But in any event, the only thing the examiner can do at this stage, according to the statute, is examine whether or not he's competent to stand trial and whether he's competent to refuse medication. Nothing in here directs the examiner to consider the cell factors, and if they did, if it was a psychologist, the psychologist couldn't give an opinion on the cell factors because that's not a physician. It's not the psychologist can't give the medical evidence that's necessary to hit the second, third, and fourth cell factors.
Right. So in 3DM, does that prohibit a psychiatrist from giving an opinion?
I would say yes, because in the case that it's a psychiatrist, one of the factors the psychiatrist has to address is whether or not medication is necessary to render the defendant competent for trial. And there is no way the psychiatrist is going to know. He's only met with the defendant for 1 hour at that point. He hasn't developed a treatment plan for him. The defendant not only hasn't been treated, but under that section of the statute, he can't be treated. He's only being examined. He hasn't been committed for treatment yet. There's no way that the doctor is going to know that no other alternative will work. He's got to be able to say, we need involuntary medication because no alternative works. So I don't think cell fits there.
Wait. So what part of cell requires that?
That would be the second factor. I believe it's the third factor, where the doctor has to opine that no other that is necessary to further a government interest. Involuntary medication is necessary to further the government's interest. And one of the really important things to notice about CEL
is that is the second factor, is that a medical determination or a legal determination?
Well, you need medical evidence. It is a legal determination. And that, I'm glad you mentioned that, Your Honor, because the big conflict here, the big conflict as I see it, is that the medical standard, the substantive legal standard that the legislature put into 971.14 in 1989, it's the same standard they put in 51 and 971.16 and a bunch of different statutes. And that standard says, let's look at the defendant and see, is he so mentally ill that he can't understand enough to make an informed choice? And if that's the case, then you defer to the doctor at that point. Under the 1989 standard and under Chapter 51 and every place else that the incompetent to refuse medication standard appears, it's the doctor who decides the treatment decisions and medication, and he does it without any court supervision whatsoever. Yeah. So that's the fundamental difference between the current standard and CEL, because CEL says step back.
CEL's second factor is the court must conclude that involuntary medication will significantly further the state's interests, right?
Right.
So that doesn't sound like a medical opinion to me. That sounds like the court says, all right, doctor, you tell me, can you, administering these medications, can you get them back to competency? Doctor says yes. Okay, now the court has to figure out, will that significantly further the state's interest? And here, that is getting the person back to competency so he can stand trial.
Well, here's the difficulty with what you just said, Your Honor. And this is very important. You can't just read CEL and look at the four main factors. Every one of them has several subfactors. And on the one that you just mentioned, Your Honor, it says one of the pieces of evidence that the court has to have is, will this medication, this proposed medication, cause side effects that will interfere with the defendant's ability to assist counsel and participate. Side effects is medical. Psychologist doesn't get to talk about that. That's the physician. And the cases that I cited in the initial brief, Chavez, Evans, Contner, even 971.14 itself over in sub 5 say you must have a physician and you must have a treatment plan, and then the court looks at the medical evidence and the court makes the legal decision. I agree with you. The court makes the legal decision. Are we going to approve this? Does it satisfy the CEL factors? But the difference between the current standard and the CEL standard is, current standard, doctor gets to make all those decisions without court oversight. CEL pulls back. CEL says, nope, I'm sorry. Now doctors are presenting evidence to the court. Court gets to make the decision on whether or not there's medication.
Is there anything in 971.14 that requires the court to defer to the doctor?
Well, that is exactly how the statute is designed. So 3DM is a perfect example. When it tells the examiner that it must, it only has to address the subject of whether or not the defendant's incompetent to refuse medication, then the next thing that happens, he's not competent, the doctor can medicate. But let's get to 4B, because that's pretty important. 4B is the stage in the statute where the court is holding the competency hearing. And the way this statute is designed right now is it's saying you both get to decide whether he's competent to stand trial, and you get to decide whether or not he's competent to refuse medication. Well, at this stage of the game, you're still just a few weeks into the fact that we've understood this defendant to be incompetent for trial. There's still not sufficient information, even if you had a psychiatrist at this point, to know whether or not no other alternatives would, less intrusive alternatives would work. And here, the interesting point about this is, if we agree that over on 3DM, we're talking about an examiner who's just looking at the condition of the defendant as opposed to proposing the treatment plan, you get over to 4B where you're having the hearing. What evidence is the court supposed to be looking at that stage in order to apply the CEL factors?
Well, right. So
they can't.
Well, that's, and that might be a problematic situation if the state didn't adduce the information required by Settle. But is there anything in the statute that prohibits the state from adducing the information required by Settle?
And the point that I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is the way the statute is set up, it's way too early for the state to even, yes, it is, because you're too early in the process for that to happen. Let's just pause it for 1 second and think about how does this work in federal court where they deal with cell all the time. There you find the defendant incompetent to stand trial. You commit him, just as we would here, you commit him to their version of DHS, and they examine him and treat him. They attempt treatment for like 4 months. And then if the defendant, if it seems like he can't be rendered competent without medication, the doctor alerts the district attorney or the U.S. attorney in that instance and says, look, I can't, we're not going to get him competent without medication. And then the U.S. attorney files a motion with the court and says, I need involuntary medication and I believe it's justified under these four cell factors, and you have an example of that in the appendix to the amicus brief that was filed in this case. And this is a very, very important point, and Justice Kelly, I really want to answer your question. In my view, cell directly conflicts with three. It directly conflicts with four, but it especially conflicts with 5DM in the statute, or 5AM, I'm sorry. In that statute, and this should really be troubling the state of Wisconsin, Your Honor, in that statute, what it says is if we haven't had any ruling thus far on whether the defendant's incompetent to refuse medication, at this stage, the department, DHS, may file a motion for an involuntary medication hearing. Now, that should be sort of offensive, I think, to the state of Wisconsin, to the district attorneys. It should be the district attorneys who are filing the motion requesting involuntary medication, because the district attorney at that point should be saying to itself, well, the first cell factor is there an important governmental interest at stake here where I want to seek medication? And I could imagine a district attorney saying, this is a misdemeanor with, you know, a 3-month House of Correction sentence or something. I don't have an important governmental interest. I'm not going to even, I don't even want to have a hearing on this. We're just going to dispose of the case some other way. But here we have the doctor bringing the motion. That isn't how it works in federal court. That's not how it works in any of the other cases that I cited to you. And the second major conflict here, and this is a big one, the standard that the doctor has to meet in order to get medications, it's written right in the statute. Licensed physician has to assert that the defendant, quote, needs medication or treatment and that he's incompetent to refuse medication or treatment. That doesn't comply with cell at all. Cell has those four factors. Is it, you know, substantially likely to render him competent? Is it unlikely, that substantially unlikely to have side effects? And then cell also asks, have all less intrusive alternatives been attempted? And very importantly, something that isn't considered under the current statute, what about this defendant? What's his medical condition? Does he have diabetes? Are they proposing a second-generation antipsychotic that can really increase the chances of diabetes or things like that?
Right. So let's stipulate that the cell factors are really important. And beyond that, they're required, right? So there's no conflict on that. So the question is whether those cell factors can be honored within the context of 97114.
That is correct.
So the only way, and I take it that you understand that the statute is unconstitutional facially only if there is no possible way of applying it in a constitutional fashion.
That is correct.
Okay. So if there is, so what you are saying is that that 97114 affirmatively requires something that cell prohibits.
Yes.
Okay. And the things that you believe,
or cell affirmatively requires something that 971.14 prohibits. That would be the other way. You can get a conflict either way.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So let's let's focus just on those things. So
okay.
I kind of look at these things as a Venn diagram.
I agree.
Right? We've got Cell, we've got 97114, and they don't line up. But the question is there any overlap such that 97114 could be applied consistently with what Cell requires, right?
Right.
Okay. And you're saying these are completely separate circles.
I'm saying they're completely separate, and I'm also saying that 971.14 is designed in a way that prohibits Cell's application. That's what I'm arguing. And I just went through that. Under 3DM, you can't apply Cell there because if it's a psychologist, that's a Cell violation. If it's a psychiatrist, it's way too early in the process for a psychiatrist to know that no less intrusive alternative can work. So you can't apply it at that stage. Now,
let me on that point in particular, I want to explore that because it seems that the facts in this case suggest that there was an investigation into less intrusive ways of bringing him back to competency, right? There was the OCRP program.
Right.
And he was ordered to participate in that, yeah?
He was what?
He was ordered to participate.
Yes,
in that?
He was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's less intrusive than involuntary medication, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And so the involuntary medication petition didn't arrive until he'd been found clinically inappropriate to participate further in the OCRP program.
That's true.
Okay. So at least the way it played out in this case, it seems to me like, if they were following 97114, there was an opportunity to inquire into less intrusive ways of getting them to competency to stand trial.
Well, they weren't even contemplating medication until he got to Mendota. And there, what you have are psychologists saying, we need to medicate, not trying other types of things. So, for example, whatever the competency education they might have been trying in outpatient competency, that isn't cognitive behavioral therapy. We don't know what all of the other less intrusive means were that were or were not attempted at Mendota. But we know one thing for sure, that not all the less intrusive alternatives worked. Rachel Fitzgerald became competent without medication. And so this order in this case clearly does not comply with Cell. I mean, there was no attempt to even address the Cell factors, and we know the outcome, which is pretty unusual by the time we get a case up to this court.
Does the crux of your argument for facial unconstitutionality rest on 4B? Because the way I read that, it mandates that the court shall issue the involuntary medication order if the standard under 3DM is met, and 3DM does not incorporate the Cell factor. So in other words, one way of reading it is that it removes from the court's discretion the ability to consider the Cell factors if the 3DM standard is met.
Your Honor, I think that's an excellent point, and that's one of several reasons why I think that this statute is unconstitutional. It's exactly the point you just made. The very end part of 4B is basically saying, look, I found him incompetent. Now doctors, we're deferring to you. You can medicate. But at that stage of the game, the court doesn't have the testimony or the evidence that it needs on the Cell factors.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a way of saving the statute, if you will, if a court, in fact, did consider the Cell factors because the state did present the requisite evidence to meet the Cell standard, and then the court actually issued the order under 4B with a full vetting of the Cell factors and the evidence presented to support them?
Your Honor, I don't think that's possible for the reason I said before. Unfortunately, the way this statute is written, it's not designed to accommodate the Cell standards, Cell factors. So the only way you'd get that evidence is you've ordered the exam over under 3DM, which doesn't say anything about the Cell factors, and in fact says the examination report we're going to get can be done by an examiner which may not be a psychiatrist, and it collapses. By the time we get to the 4B hearing, you're talking about a very short period of time, right? And there's not enough time at that point to know whether no alternative treatments would work. So, but I think it's really important to keep in mind 5 a.m. too, because that statute flagrantly violates CEL. So I guess another point I would like to make to the court is I think we can all agree that these two standards are starkly different, right? And CEL has been on the books. It has been a mandate from the United States Supreme Court for 16 years, and we've had the mandatory circuit court form, we've had jury instructions and a judicial bench book, and our bench and our bar have not been able to reconcile those two in 16 years. And I think if this court does not declare that statute unconstitutional, you're just going to put the circuit courts in the position of having to try and make those reconciliations of the disputes of and really they're going to do what's most comfortable. Here we've got this statute, we've got these books, but we've got the statute, we've got the books. I'll just go with the plain language of the statute.
Can you address the form? Because that seems to be a big part of the state's argument is that, and I've filled these out before, that you're going through the cell factors with these forms. So the form imports the cell factors into the statute.
Your Honor, they don't address the cell factors, and that's exactly the problem. For one thing, you'll notice on the form that it doesn't reference cell. So I'm not sure circuit court judges, district attorneys, or public defenders know where those factors are coming from. But secondly, in the reply brief that I submitted, there's an appendix that includes a stack of transcripts and these orders, and you can tell that circuit courts are looking at the statute at best. They either find the defendant incompetent to stand trial and automatically order involuntary meds. It's become the default in Wisconsin. Or they look at the form and they don't know what that is and they just check the box 3. And that's problematic because box 3 requires a finding of dangerousness and nobody's finding dangerousness at this stage. So in terms of the application, I apologize. I see my time is up.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Maura Whalen, appearing for the state. The state agrees with Raytrell Fitzgerald that before entering an order to involuntarily medicate an incompetent defendant, a circuit court must apply CEL. The state disagrees that 97114 is unconstitutional on its face on the ground that it does not explicitly incorporate the CEL factors. The state legislature is not required to amend a statute to incorporate a new constitutional norm whenever this court or the U.S. Supreme Court issues one. Notably, the U.S. Congress has not enacted or amended legislation to codify CEL. The statute most closely corresponding to 97114 is 18 U.S. 4241, which governs competency proceedings and allows commitment if the court finds by the preponderance that the defendant is incompetent. It does not incorporate CEL. How does the federal government obtain an order to involuntarily medicate a defendant to competency? It files a CEL motion, which is untethered to any statute. The statute does not preclude the incorporation and use of the CEL standards by the circuit court. I find it ironic that Mr. Fitzgerald looks to DM, which is the provision talking about whether a defendant is incompetent to refuse medication. I find it ironic to look to that statute and concept to state that the statute's unconstitutional, because in fact, that's an example in which the statute is more protective than CEL. CEL
does not require a showing that a person is is incompetent to refuse medication. And so, therefore, under Sell, a person may be involuntarily medicated even if he is competent to refuse medication. That looks to me like our statute gives something to defendants that Sell does not. I think the provision that I understood counsel to be saying was unconstitutional is the last sentence of 971.14.4b, which is that if the defendant is found incompetent and not competent to refuse medication, the court shall make a determination that the defendant is not competent to refuse medication and order that whoever administers the medication shall observe appropriate medical standards. I cannot understand how that sentence precludes the application of the four cell factors.
Counsel, I think the argument is that 4B requires the involuntary medication order upon satisfaction of the standard described in 3DM.
Yes.
Right? And the statute in 3DM does not, certainly does not incorporate the cell factors.
Correct.
Right? Okay. And Mr. Fitzgerald says the standard in 3DM is inconsistent with cell. So how do you, for your argument to work, you have to be able to squeeze cell somewhere inside of 3DM, don't you?
No, I disagree with that. I think 3DM and cell are launched two separate but not inconsistent inquiries. Cell inquiry is this person has a constitutional right not to be involuntarily medicated. Does the state's interest in trying that defendant, because he also has an interest in not being tried if he's incompetent, does the state's interest in trying that defendant overcome his interest in not being involuntarily medicated? Sell then sets out a very typical sort of constitutional framework for making sure that as a substantive due process matter, the defendant's rights are not being improperly overborne by what the state wants to do. What DM does, and this is the case in many other mental health statutes, has an inquiry about when do we determine whether a person is incompetent to refuse medication. That is a separate inquiry to whether a person can be involuntarily medicated as a matter of substantive due process.
Well, cell controls that question, right? When a defendant can be involuntarily medicated.
As a matter of substantive due process, that's right.
And then 3DM, it answers the same question, doesn't it? Should this defendant be involuntarily medicated? And that comes from the interplay between 4B and 3DM, because 4B says if you satisfy the 3DM statute, the court shall order the involuntary medication, right?
The Sell sets out floor, I guess, not the ceiling, as a matter of substantive due process, whether a person can be involuntarily medicated. DM provides an additional layer of protection. According to DM, and of course this was pre-Sell, it's not like the legislature thought it through this way, but once you have Sell, DM does not allow involuntary medication even if the cell factors are satisfied, unless a person is incompetent to refuse medication.
So is the circuit court supposed to ignore the statutory mandate in 4B that if the standard in DM is met, it won't issue the order unless the cell factors are met, because then isn't the circuit court not following the law in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, the statute, actually, the language of the statute is a little fuzzy, unfortunately, so that it, I think it makes it even easier to read it together with cell. The statute says if 3DM is satisfied, the court shall issue an order that the defendant is not incompetent to refuse medication, and whoever administers medication shall observe appropriate medical standards. The language of the statute doesn't even say that the state shall therefore administer medication. I mean, I understand that's being implied, but it's not so strict that that it precludes the incorporation of the cell standard here. You know, I just don't see any conflict between this language and cell. I see an absence of cell.
But if the court issues an order that the defendant is not competent to refuse medication, and then that section goes on to say whoever administers the medication shall observe appropriate medical standards, in effect, that order is going to result in the administration of medication involuntarily to the...
Yes, well, I agree it implies that, but it doesn't necessitate that, and therefore I don't think that the language can be read as precluding application of cell.
Well, counsel, what's the point of the language, if not to order medication involuntarily?
Well, prior to cell, I think that is what it meant. But this statute...
Counsel, let me just stop you right there. It's going to mean the same thing before and after cell. The only question is whether they're consistent.
We have statutes on our books, for instance, particularly in the arrest and search and seizure and stop and frisk area, where we've got the statutory language and we get decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court and this court all the time, adding nuances to what the language of those statutes mean, and those statutes are not repeatedly revised and updated every time there's a new Supreme Court decision. I do not think that this language precludes cell. It says that there will be an order if there's the person's incompetent to refuse medication. It doesn't suggest that there can't be any other considerations.
Counsel, was the order filled out the form filled out for this order that was then stayed? Is that someplace in the record?
Yes, it's. I've got it here, so I can tell you.
Okay.
It's in Mr. Fitzgerald's appendix.
Okay.
It's pages 101 to 103.
Thank you very much.
And the first, and it was amended, but that was just because of a mistake with his name. But so if you look at 101 and 102, it's repeated. And what the order says is involuntary administration of medication, and box B is marked. And then box B goes on to catalog the cell factors.
Is it your argument, then, that this form is enough even if the circuit court didn't make these findings on the record or have any evidence about these findings, that all you have to do is check off a box on a form?
Absolutely not, no. And I certainly the form... counsel has attached cases to her reply brief, and I'm not going to go in and argue about each case, but certainly there may be and seem to be cases where courts are just checking off this box without really making on the record detailed findings or even requiring detailed evidence. And I
do not dispute that there may be cases where these orders do not comply with SELL.
What about this case?
I think
that the circuit court actually went through these factors that are checked off in
I think that in this case, the court's order was arguably very weak under SELL, and there's one factor that I think we can't deny that the court didn't review, which is, I think of it as 2B, which is the part of the second factor that says you have to consider side effects. And and in my brief, I argued, well, we can look back and see that the psychiatrist was thinking of that, but here the court did not. What I think is, but this doesn't make the statute unconstitutional. If there's a bad order, the cure is appeal to the Court of Appeals. I would certainly think that as a matter of best practice, courts should not simply be checking, but going through each of the factors, explicating them, and making it clear what evidence they think supports each factor.
Right, but the argument here is that by conflating this determination that needs to be made about the involuntary order for or order for medication to be given against someone's will, essentially, that by conflating that finding with the finding of competency, that there's no way that the court can give it the kind of attention that SELL requires it to have. I mean, that's the gist of what the argument is here. And I want you to address that, and you cited to the federal statute, which I just looked up, and it says nothing, it doesn't conflate it in the federal statute. The statute you cited deals with competency.
Right.
You've decided competency, mm-hmm. then you can make a determination based mm-hmm. on information that comport with SELL as to whether the person should be involuntarily medicated. But to conflate those two, what you're doing is, the argument is that you can't possibly reach the SELL factors because you just don't have enough information at that stage from the right people.
Okay, well, in terms of conflating them, I just have a hard time understanding why the court can't make both findings. But the other issue you brought up about whether the court has the evidence it should have, that's a different problem. That's not a problem with the facial constitutionality of the statute. That's the problem of the court not requiring enough information from the state. And I do think that one thing that's helpful looking to the federal cases is that the federal cases give some good examples of how these hearings should be supported. But if, in fact, the state isn't bringing in sufficient evidence or the circuit court is not requiring sufficient evidence, that doesn't make the statute unconstitutional. Something I wanted to address that came up in a number of different ways in the briefs and the argument has to do with medical evidence. And medical evidence is certainly required, but medical evidence and psychiatric testimony are two different things. I don't see anywhere in SELL where psychiatric testimony is required. And I would note that the cases Chavez and Robert S. cited on page 27 of Fitzgerald's opening brief do not say that they say a psychiatrist must prescribe medication. There's no question here that any medication prescribed was prescribed by psychiatrists. That is different from whether an examiner and what an examiner is defined by the statute, a person with specialized knowledge to be appropriate to examine and report upon the condition of the defendant. Usually these people are psychologists. They report on those reports, and you can look at Dr. Garcia's report, include psychiatric information and the information from people here at Mendota who are dealing with Mr. Fitzgerald on a daily basis, and the psychologist's own interviews. There's nothing about that kind of evidence that conflicts with Sell. And Dr. Garcia reported to the court what was prescribed, and she even said, by the way, I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't prescribe medications, but this is what the psychiatrist prescribed. Testimony, by the way, that Fitzgerald did not object to. He also stipulated to her qualifications as an appropriate witness. So it's a little frustrating to have those things challenged here because Fitzgerald stipulated to them.
Well, but we have to consider that in a broader scope, not just what Fitzgerald stipulated to. Can a psychologist testify to what is medically appropriate for a specific patient?
Yes, if that is based on both the psychologist's knowledge in her practice and her certification and discussions with the prescribing psychiatrist, as also happened here. And whether a particular psychologist, and there's case law saying that psychologists, these are mostly evidentiary questions, I guess, are qualified to give evidence about pharmaceuticals, even if they can't prescribe pharmaceuticals. I would think that it would be a valid issue of cross-examination for a defendant to say, you know, you're not qualified to object or question or try to undermine a psychologist's testimony about medications. But there's nothing per se inappropriate about a psychologist testifying to medications because...
And the cases to which you refer in which psychologists are allowed to testify about medication, is that about medication in general? Or as used in a particular patient?
In a particular case. I've just written down one here from federal court in Virginia called Beck versus Angelone, 113 F sub 2nd 941. But it's very clear, and just as here, nowhere do courts or psychologists make the mistake of thinking a psychologist can prescribe. But they're not prescribing. And I think that particularly the way the psychiatric and psychological practice has evolved today is that psychiatrists seem to spend most of their time prescribing. So if you want to have one examiner who's going to put together all the pieces in somebody's story, it makes sense that it would be the psychologist who has a broader a broader plate of things they're looking at. In the 980 cases, the people who provide the reports are usually psychologists, I believe, although, of course, there's psychiatric evidence underlying that.
Counsel, I'm going to press you a bit, if I may, on the issue of the side effects. The first issue we've talked about here is the constitutionality of the statute. Mm-hmm. We've also now been addressing whether or not the order that was issued violated substantive due process because the state wasn't held to prove the cell factors. You have acknowledged that with regard to the cell factors, that the second part of the second cell factor is...
absent.
Okay, I was going to be nicer to you, but absent is fine. And that you try to resurrect that absence and explain that absence and saying, well, there's something in the record. It's implicitly satisfied because the record indicates that there was a prescription for a medication that treats side effects.
Mm-hmm.
The standard under CEL is it must find that administration of the drugs is substantially unlikely to have side effects that will interfere significantly with the defendant's ability to assist counsel in conducting a trial defense. I just don't see how you can save it with trying to refer back to this prescription from benztropine and say, well, it's implicit. I mean, the language of CEL is much more explicit. In reference to that, I just don't think makes it. Can you?
Well, Your Honor. Well, I won't. Your Honor, this is, I was making the best argument on side effects I thought was possible based on. We are not defending the current order because the current order is moot. Mr. Fitzgerald was found competent, pleaded guilty, sentenced to time served. He's this doubly not subject to this order. However, I think that that absence is good fodder for the court to put together what I referred to earlier as best practices, and particularly specifically about side effects, the language you just read. I think the circuit court has to go back to that language and then apply the language to the evidence the circuit court has received from the state. And I think that the other factors, I think there was evidence here, but I also think that the court's discussion of some of the other factors was also conclusory, and I think that it's easier, certainly, if, as I think, if a defendant thinks an order violated CEL, then his solution is to go to the appeals court. Certainly, it will be a lot easier for an appeals court to analyze an involuntary medication order if the circuit court has gone through the steps and said, I know this is the requirement, side effects, for example, and this is the evidence in the examiner's report from her testimony or report or both that supports my finding that this is satisfied.
Counsel, what was the potential sentence for the violation Mr. Fitzgerald was being prosecuted?
I know why you're asking that.
10 years.
Okay, thank you. Okay. 10 years, I certainly.
Thank you. Is Dr. Garcia's report the best evidence that you have that involuntary medication will significantly further the goal of bringing Mr. Fitzgerald competence?
I'm since we're talking about the best practices in the test, I'm really glad you brought that up. I do not believe that step one of the CEL test is a question for the examiner. I believe that that is a question for the district attorney. And certainly there's some evidence, like this was the crime, this is the sentence, but I think it would mostly be a matter of argument for the district attorney on that, because
and that might be suggested by the fact that we review the first element de novo.
Correct, right, okay. Right. And but I don't think that there should be a per se rule like, you know, X sentence means it's an important governmental interest. I think that the circuit court has to make a balanced analysis of the crime and the consequences of not trying this person on this crime. And it's just, there just should not be a per se rule. That's really all I think about
that. Let's move you along through the factors a little bit. So is it your position that Dr. Garcia's report is the best evidence that involuntary medication will significantly further the goal of bringing Mr. Fitzgerald to competency?
Yes. In fact, I would say on the second, third, and fourth factors in this case, it's the only evidence.
All right. And then what is it in Dr. Garcia's report that tells you that involuntary medication will accomplish that goal?
The under the second factor?
Mm-hmm. Let me just perhaps direct you a little bit. Is it the difference in his behavior and outlook and all of that before and after taking medication?
Yes. Well, that's right. There was sort of a negative implication on that. So now we're in factor two, part A, in comparing his behavior and his affect when he was on medication and when he was not on medication. Because, in fact, he was on medication sometimes. So there was information about how he responded to the medication. I see my time is running out. I just want to be sure to respond to one thing that counsel brought up, and that has to do with the timing and how the way this system is brought up, there isn't enough time to make these findings authentically. That is a huge new argument that we did not respond to because I've never seen or heard that argument before. I can't really even opine on whether I think that's a difficult argument for me. The other thing I wanted to make sure that the court understands that subsection 5AM, and I do say this in our brief, but I didn't convince opposing counsel of it. 5AM is where DHS can ask for a medication order. That is not part of the medicating to competency process. That, I think, arises if DHS has somebody and they're not being medicated. Maybe it's because there's a stay under Scott, and that person is acting out and violent, and DHS says, well, you know, I don't know what you are doing in the DA's office, but we're having trouble with this person, and we want this person medicated because he's dangerous. It's a DHS-initiated motion for involuntary medication. It is not initiated by the court. Everything the court does is 971.14, 2, 3, and 4. That's the court process for involuntary medication, for treatment to competency. And 5AM is just, it's a different animal. And I don't know if it's used for anything other than what I suggested, you know, dangerousness. DHS doesn't have an institutional interest and into trial. That's the court's interest, the district attorney's interest, and in many cases, I think the defendant's interest. Here we are. Thank you.
Your Honor, opposing counsel fundamentally misunderstands 5AM. If you look at it, that statute says zero about dangerousness. That statute comes into play when you're at the 3DM stage, and for some reason the examiner does not have sufficient information to address incompetence to refuse medication, so that it doesn't get addressed at that point, and it doesn't get addressed at the 4B hearing. 5 a.m. is where DHS comes back in, and it is very explicit about what the standard is. It says, does the defendant need treatment, and is he incompetent to refuse medication?
Doesn't DHS have to have custody of the person to make that motion?
Yes. My problem here is it's DHS making the motion when it should be the government making the motion based on, in particular, the first cell factor. And while we haven't briefed this issue because we're not discussing dangerousness today, DHS already has the authority to render someone non-dangerous within an institution. They have it under Harper, and I believe there's a DHS regulation that authorizes that too. So that's not what 5 a.m. is about. I think a really important point, a really important takeaway today, this court is, I believe, going to say, hey, Wisconsin Circuit Courts, you must follow Sell versus United States. It's binding in every state and federal court in the country. But an important point to note here is Sell really does require medical evidence. It requires a treatment plan. You can look at the federal cases on it, or you can just look at Sell, because under both the second and the fourth factors, Sell says we need to know dosages. That's the psychiatrist. We need to know what the antipsychotic medication is. We need to know the dosages.
Counsel, are you suggesting that the court would be inquiring into the dosage and approving dosages?
No, this is thank you for asking that question, Your Honor. I think that it is incumbent upon the state, when it brings a motion for involuntary medication, to present a treatment plan, which is going to say, we're going to consider two different medications here. We're going to start like this. The maximum dosage we'll be doing is this. We don't want doctors coming back for more and more approval for each medication decision. They set a plan up front. And then if it doesn't work, well, then there's a different kind of motion later on down the road. But, no, it's not that level of court oversight. So I guess the point I'd like to leave the court with today is involuntary medications have been the default in the state of Wisconsin for a long time. We find defendants incompetent, and then we order involuntary medication. And that means there's probably a lot of involuntary medication orders out there that violated a defendant's right to substantive due process under Sell. Okay? And that's a very – what you're going to do today, I hope, with the Sell case, will be a dramatic change for the circuit courts, a dramatic change for both the district attorneys and the public defenders. And I think that if this court wants to stem the tide of the substantive due process violations, it can't leave these two wildly different, incompatible standards on the books and Sell coming down from on high. What if the court really wants to stop litigation in this field, declare the statute unconstitutional. It's extremely easy to do. There's just a few provisions. You have to strike 3DM.
Counsel, we would have, if we did what you said, we'd have nothing while someone was actively psychotic that we could use to try to move forward to making that person competent and able to stand trial.
I disagree, Your Honor. You may sever the statute. You may do that under 990.001 sub 11, and you only have to sever very small parts of this statute. Most of this statute is great.
The statute, from what you sever, is not, according to your argument, is not going to be consistent with Sell either. So if we agreed with you, when we blanked out every part that you raised, there isn't enough there under the argument you're making to comply with Sell either.
There is. There's exactly enough left for the government to bring a Sell motion just like they do in federal court. There is exactly enough left for that purpose.
Couldn't we just strike the provision in 4B that requires the court to issue an order if the 3DM standard was satisfied and make that may instead of shall?
No, Your Honor.
In that way, giving them room to incorporate the Sell standards.
Well, you still have the problem, of course, with 5 a.m. And I think that the incompetent to refuse medication is irrelevant and confusing, and in my mind really conflicts. What you need to know at this stage of the proceeding is the defendant competent or incompetent to stand trial? If he's incompetent, then is he refusing medication, and then you go to Sell. So you'd strike 3DM. You'd strike a reference to DM in 3E. You'd strike the parts we've talked about in 4B, and you'd strike 5A M. Everything else remains the same, and the way the district attorneys and the courts can move forward, all the rest of the statute's great. You just bring a cell motion the same way you do in federal court. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for a really complicated case and very interesting arguments and fine briefs as well. We're going to take a brief recess so the students can leave. And then we will be back after a short recess. So we are adjourned.